This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is on vacation. It used to be that a quick way to test a person's civic IQ was to ask them to name the 9 justices of the Supreme Court. Now there's a new test. Can you name the following 9 Democratic presidential candidates?
I am enthusiastic, energetic, and anxious to take on this campaign and to be the next president of the United States.
The American people deserve to have both security and prosperity.
I come to you today humbly but purposefully to say to you that I know we can do better in the United States of America.
We have got to take control of this government out of the hands of that handful of insiders who are running it right now and give it back to its people.
The American people want to believe again, and I'm here to take a message of hope.
I'm someone who has a personal experience that they can relate to and somebody they can trust.
I want to be president because I believe that it's important to have a full employment economy.
There's an enormous hunger in this country, not just by Democrats, but by independents, to see somebody in the White House who stands up for principles that are good for the country.
I probably have more national experience than anyone in the race. I run a national organization. I am the youngest candidate in the race with the longest progressive record.
Don't worry, we're not keeping score. We'll tell you. The 9 contenders are Senators Bob Graham of Florida, Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, John Kerry of Massachusetts, John Edwards of North Carolina, and former Senator from Illinois, Carol Moseley Braun, Congressman Dick Gephardt of Missouri and Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, Howard Dean, the former governor of Vermont, and Reverend Al Sharpton, a well-known political activist. Now, if you think you're having trouble keeping the candidates straight, just think how they feel trying to find a way to get the public's attention and to reach the top of the pack in such a crowded field. It's too early to say who's got the lead, but it's not too early to begin paying attention to what the candidates are saying and to assess how they're doing in that all-important part of modern presidential politics, fundraising. What do you think the Democratic contenders need to be addressing in their campaigns? Who's your favorite and why? And how would you advise a candidate to pull ahead of the pack? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. With us now to talk about the group of 9 is Neil Oxman. He's a Democratic political consultant who's run 3 presidential campaigns for Senators Edward Kennedy in 1980, Alan Cranston in 1984, and Al Gore in 1988. He's president of the Campaign Group, a political consulting firm. Neil Oxman joins us from member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks for being with us, Neil.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I guess the first question is this the largest field of Democratic candidates ever, or have there been more?
Well, it's close to the largest field of people who are this close to the election running. I think it is the closest field and the largest field in modern times.
Well, let's talk first about the candidate who seems to be getting the most attention, at least at the moment, Howard Dean. Why is there so much interest in his candidacy right now?
I think that Dean has captured 2 groups of people and who are both sort of from the same stripe but of different ages. The old-fashioned liberals of the 1960s, people who I sort of think of as Rob Reiner, who's thinking about running for governor of California, the movie director, the old-fashioned McCarthy, Kennedy, McGovern liberals of the 1960s, many of them are for Howard Dean. And then the other thing he's done, I think, incredibly well, which just came about, or the news of it just came public a few weeks ago, these young people who live on the internet, whose worlds are computers. Dean has raised millions and millions of dollars in this sort of underground economy, political activism core that's out there. And I think that these 2 groups of people have made Dean kind of stand out right now.
Explain how he has tapped into the internet in this campaign and particularly in fundraising.
Well, my friends will laugh because I'm not very computer savvy, but the fact is that lots of people talk out there and in chat rooms. And I think that what Dean did early on was stand up at a number of these forums and say, I'm the real Democrat. I'm the one true real Democrat in this race. And I think that the anger that some Democrats, especially Democratic activists, feel with the Bush administration, with the war in Iraq, with the economy, has made them gravitate. And I think that the sort of network, the secret network that people run on, you know, on chat rooms and computers and the way people talk to each other is something that the Dean campaign has done a masterful job of capturing.
But if Dean is tapping possibly into the most liberal wing of the Democratic Party, appealing to those opposed to U.S. involvement in Iraq, for instance, could that hurt him eventually? I mean, you mentioned that he's like McCarthy or McGovern, neither of whom did very well in their runs for the presidency.
Well, when the Democratic Party rules were changed for the 1972 convention after Chicago in 1968. What's happened is, generally, the Democrats have nominated the most viable liberal in the race. Dukakis, I mean, and because the Democratic primaries and caucuses are set up really for activists to be a part of. They're not broad things where every Democrat votes, but in Iowa, as you know, a relatively few thousand people go to these caucuses and somebody gets a bump out of Iowa. Then you go to New Hampshire and a relatively few thousand people vote. And because the system is set up like that, the Democratic Party rules, liberals, i.e. activists, have a larger say in Democratic primary presidential politics than they do in the general election as a whole.
Let's talk about fundraising. Who's doing the best in fundraising right now of the candidates?
Well, Kerry and Lee, I mean, there's sort of two tiers out there. The top six, Graham, Edwards, Kerry, Lieberman, Gephardt, and Dean all have roughly the same amount of money, with Dean's second quarter of calendar year 2003 being remarkable. And then the other three, Kucinich, Mosley, Braun, and Sharpton, are really nowhere. No one has jumped out. Everybody has sort of $10 or $12 million of these Democrats, the top six Democrats. And the only separation, Lynn, that has occurred is in how much money Dean raised in the second quarter of 2003.
Which was what, about $7 million?
$6 to $7 million, yes.
And that means what? What does that mean?
Well, I mean, it means that he can run remember, in politics, if you sit and you look at the history of politics in the Almanac of American Politics, one of the rules is he or she who spends the most money wins. And if you can shout louder than the other guy or the other woman, you have a better chance of winning. And if Dean continues to capture money like this, he can spend more money on advertising, he can have a larger staff, he can travel better, and he can do all those things that campaigns are made of.
Apart from this surge that Dean has had, are there any other clues from what's going on in fundraising that would predict where the race might go?
I don't think from fundraising. I think that the fundraising is fairly equal overall. I think that the thing that Dean's fundraising coup did, Lynn, was to push him on the front page of almost every major newspaper in the country. I mean, he was literally on the front page of the New York Times and lots of other papers around the country because he didn't raise money in a traditional way, running around doing fundraisers. He raised scads of money, you know, in a secret way on the internet. And I guarantee you that a week before the filing, before this became public, none of the other campaign managers of the major presidential campaigns had any idea this was going to happen and were just startled by this.
If you'd like to join our discussion on the Democratic presidential race, give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. And what about Sharpton, Braun, and Kucinich? Where do they fit into this pegging order?
Right now they are, I mean, you can't call them nuisances, but for the party bosses, in the major cities, the Democratic governors of the big states, the mayors of the big cities, you know, the leaders of Congress of the Democrats would hope that they would disappear very quickly. When you think about this, if there's a Democratic presidential debate and it's 90 minutes long, which is fairly long for primetime television, and there are nine candidates, mythically, they only get 10 minutes apiece. When you take out times for introductions, questions, and answers, the candidates get 6 or 7 minutes apiece. With nine candidates in there, there's really not a lot of time for any one of the major six to define himself or to separate himself from the pack. And so I think that if you asked off the record, you know, the Democratic governors of the big states or the, you know, the major members of Congress, the Democratic leaders in Congress, I think they would like Kucinich and Sharpton and Mosley Braun to sort of drop out of the race right now.
I mean, if they have so little chance of winning, what's in it for them? Why do they do it?
Oh, I think running for president's about ego. I mean, you know, I've worked in three presidential campaigns, and that's not to say that none of those three people want to serve. I think clearly they are all people who have long careers in public service. Certainly Dennis Kucinich was twice the mayor of Cleveland and a longtime congressman now, and Carol Mosley Braun was a longtime office holder in Illinois before she became a senator. I mean, people want to serve, and it's America. And if you get enough signatures on petitions, you can get on the ballot in New Hampshire. And you ask at the beginning of the program, Lynn, how many people run for president? Will you know that when the time of the New Hampshire primary comes around, there will be 15 or 20 people file for president and run on the Democratic primary in New Hampshire, 10 of which you won't even report. The only place they'll be reported will be in, you know, the Manchester newspaper, where they'll get 600 votes each of them, and they'll be just a name on the day after the primary in January.
Yeah. Let's take a call, and I want to remind listeners the number is 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join the discussion. Matthew in Freeport, Maine. Hi, Matthew.
Hello, Lynn. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I love your show. You guys do such a great job. I just wanted to follow up with what you're talking about right now, and my question was, at what point do you think the Democratic leadership is going to make an effort to bring the party together, to coalesce all of the support behind, you know, a couple of candidates? Do you think they're going to try to weed it out early, or how long do you think it's going to go on with in a fragmented way?
Neil, will that happen? Is that a possibility?
Well, I think that there are already some conversations about that, and the answer to Matthew's question is it has to happen early, Matthew, because by the 2nd of March, 31 states will have primaries or caucuses for the Democratic nomination. So for all intents and purposes, the Democratic primary nomination will be resolved by the 2nd of March. And if this thing doesn't sort of, if what you're talking about doesn't happen in the last quarter of 2003 of this year, or very early in 2004, then who knows what's going to happen.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Matthew.
Thank you. Take care, Lynn.
Okay, thanks. I just wanted to bring up another possible candidate. We've got an email here. I just read in The Economist that General Clark may be about to join the list of Democratic candidates. Likely, who is he and how is he different from the others? And that's referring to Wesley Clark.
Well, remember, in the first 100 years of, or more than 100 years of General Wesley Clark is a member, you know, former retired general. Remember, when you go back from George Washington through Dwight Eisenhower, how many candidates for president or vice president of the United States have been heroes, have been military heroes. I mean, from, you know, and you can name tons of them. And so, you know, General Clark's, by the fact that he's a general and his CV, certainly separates him from lots of these other people because he's different, although John Kerry was a decorated war hero in Vietnam. But it certainly does help to be a general.
Now, it's not clear. There's a draft Clark campaign, but it's not clear that if he decided that he would run as a Democrat, is it?
I think that he's hinted around that if he runs, he'd run as a Democrat right now, although I think some people who are involved in that are waiting to see how the economy turns out, and maybe they'll think that, you know, this could be a Ross Perot deal where maybe 2004 is a time when, if the Democrats nominate Dean, who may be unacceptable to some part of the Democratic Party, the economy is in bad shape and Bush doesn't look so good, that maybe Clark should run as an independent then.
We're talking about the nine Democratic presidential hopefuls. We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us an email. The address is totn@npr.org. Democratic political strategist Neil Oxman is my guest. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking about the nine, that's right, nine Democratic presidential contenders. Our guest is Neil Oxman, a Democratic political consultant. What issues do you want to hear the candidates talk about? Do you have a favorite candidate yet, or are you still mulling them over? Or maybe it's just too early for you to think about presidential politics. Call us with your comments. The number is 800-989-TALK, and our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And joining us now on the phone from Cape Cod, Massachusetts, is Sam Tenenhouse, a contributing editor to Vanity Fair magazine. Thanks for being with us, Sam.
My pleasure. Nice to be with you.
You recently wrote an article for another magazine, The New Republic, where you posit the idea that in the past, the Senate was not a launching pad for making a presidential run. Give us the history of that.
Well, in fact, only two presidents in modern history have gone directly from the Senate to the White House. Warren G. Harding and John F. Kennedy. It's not a very impressive record and not all that encouraging a one.
And yet we have four current senators running and one former senator. Don't they know that record? What makes them think they can buck the trend?
Well, they do know the record. And I think one reason they may feel they have a chance to run from the Senate is because institutionally the Senate isn't exactly what it used to be. Paradoxically, because it's less powerful a component in our national politics, individual senators are not as identified with the House as they used to be, the upper chamber, and they can carve out more individual identities for themselves. This is what John Kennedy did in 1960.
Yeah, you even suggest that that the worse the senators are as legislators, or almost the better they are as presidential candidates.
Well, that certainly was the case with JFK. He was an insignificant senator at best, and some thought really negligent. He was missing from important votes. He was not a leader in any of the major legislation of the day. But what he did was to use the Senate as a kind of forum or platform for expressing his views on big topics. And then when the timing was right, he would sweep in and award himself a little credit for some of the Senate's bolder actions, though he'd had almost nothing to do with them.
To the great frustration, of course, Lyndon Johnson, who, of course, was a great legislator.
Yes, that's right. And it was clear to many that Johnson was actually being hampered by that. Here you have a great legislator from the South who helped push through important civil rights legislation while still in the Senate and paid the price for it. Kennedy never had to pay that particular political price for actions he took in the Senate. He was able to insulate himself to some extent, and also he was able to project himself as a new face, which is hard to do when you're a very familiar, powerful legislator in Washington.
Well, do you see anyone among the current field of Democratic candidates who seems to be following the Kennedy model well?
Well, following it well, that's a good question. I think Senator Kerry, who of course is a great admirer of John Kennedy, is patterning some aspects of his candidacy after Kennedy. Almost impossible not to do if one is from Massachusetts. Also, he has a war record similar to Kennedy's. He was a war hero. And he has a patrician demeanor. Now, often this has been harmful for Democratic candidates in the past, but this could be a moment where a more regal-seeming East Coast senator could actually gain some points for that. I think John Edwards' career, his career path, most nearly parallels John F. Kennedy's. He's young. He has made himself a reputation as a kind of prosecutor or litigator even in the Senate. And he has also, from the beginning, been seen by party leaders as a real star, as Kennedy also was.
What about Joe Lieberman and Bob Graham?
Well, Lieberman and Graham actually have the disadvantage of almost being too good at what they do. Lieberman, in particular, has been very involved in important senatorial activities, not legislation so much as organizational matters. He was very big in Homeland Security. And yet, even so, what is Joe Lieberman most famous for? Well, for almost having been elected vice president. I think Graham also faces a problem that's more familiar with important senators. In fact, it reminds me a little bit of Bob Dole, someone who has such a grasp of the issues and of their nuances that he's not able to present them in the very black and white sort of heroic terms that voters want. And this is a problem that senators face time and time again. I'm sure listeners will remember Bob Dole's campaign in 96. Here was someone famous in Washington for his incisive mind and his wit, but at times he verged on the unintelligible as a candidate because he thought so much in legislative terms that he couldn't translate those into the broad language, the rhetoric that voters want from a tribune, which is really what a president is.
It seems ironic and, I don't know, maybe even a little sad that the weaker the Senate becomes as an institution, the more promising it becomes for presidential candidates that come from the Senate.
Well, it does, and yet we know this is the case. A perfect example, of course, is Senator Frist's elevation. Here is someone who is essentially handpicked by the White House to become Senate Majority Leader. It's impossible to imagine that happening to Lyndon Johnson, someone so powerful in the Senate, ceding power in that way, or being a kind of junior partner to the White House. In fact, one reason JFK wanted Johnson as his vice president was to get this powerful figure out of the Senate, where he would be a kind of rival. Our politics has become much more a kind of presidential or imperial politics, as some call it, and the Senate itself really has been minimized. I think at this point, people are probably as familiar with the best-known congressman, Tom DeLay, for instance, as they are with the most visible senators.
Well, thanks so much for speaking with us today, Sam.
My pleasure.
Sam Tenenhouse is a contributing editor to Vanity Fair magazine, and he spoke to us from Wellfleet on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Neil Oxman, as someone who's run the presidential campaigns of three senators, what's your reaction to what Sam Tenenhouse was just saying?
Well, I mean, I agree with a lot of what he said, Lynn. I think that, I mean, just by the numbers, the fact that four of these eight or nine are from the Senate would mean mathematically that one of these people has a decent chance. And since you've added Wesley Clark, I'm sure you'll get a call, you know, in the next day or two from Joe Biden, who is still evidently thinking about running for the Senate, you know, figuring why not. I mean, running for president because of why not. I'm not a Senate historian, so I can't really sort of talk to the larger issues that that Sam talked about. But, you know, most people before this sort of bump the Dean has received in the last few weeks sort of thought Kerry was the favorite in this thing, and I still do too, Senator Kerry of Massachusetts. And I think this could be year that a senator is nominated. I also think there's a good chance a senator could be vice president again. I mean, I think that in reality, Bob Graham is running for vice president of the United States. And I think that the race between Edwards and Graham, if neither of them break out early in the presidential stakes, they're sort of posturing themselves to be on the ticket as vice president. Certainly in Edwards' case, so he can run for president later on, Graham would be a terrific choice for the Democrats because maybe he will bring frauders' electoral votes.
What do you think about the Democratic presidential race? Give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. Let's take a call now from Aaron in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Lynn. Nice to be on your show today. I really love listening to your show.
Thanks so much.
My question is more directed towards the new poll that just came out from Harvard Institute of Politics regarding campus kids. That came out on May the 22nd, and whether or not the nine presidential candidates will be focusing more on students this year, since they've indicated that campus kids will be this new swing vote.
Neil?
Every presidential campaign, every, you know, both sides, Democrats and Republicans, do everything they can to appeal to people under 25 to vote. And it just never happens for some reason. In terms of the population, voters 18 to 25 register vote disproportionately less than their percentage of the population and then vote disproportionately less than even that. I think that if Iraq becomes, you know, a very muddled situation as it is now, and we're really bogged down there, and the economy even gets worse than it is now, then you will have a 1992 scenario in 2004 where you did have the high point for young people voting. You had 108 million people vote for President of the United States. But, you know, MTV and Rock the Vote and everything else, I mean, you know, there is no way a young person does not know 4 weeks before the presidential campaign, 60-some weeks from now, that there will be a presidential election in 2004, and yet to get them out of their college dorm rooms or their workplaces to vote seems to be very, very hard.
Okay, thanks so much for your call, Aaron.
Thank you.
Let's bring Tom Schaller into the conversation now. Tom is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Maryland, and he joins us by phone from his office here in Washington. Tom, you wrote an article for The Washington Post last month in which you offered some unique advice to the current crop of Democratic candidates. Tell us what you think they should do.
Well, I think one of them could really set him or herself apart from the field by sort of stealing a page from George Bush's playbook in 2000, and picking a running mate. Now, Bush, of course, didn't do that Technically, he waited and sort of did the traditional thing and wait until the summer of the election year to select Dick Cheney in the run-up to the Republican National Convention. And there's really not much precedent for this sort of behavior outside of Reagan's move in 1976 to do the same. But Bush did manage to surround himself with a lot of people, and I think that allied a lot of voters' fears about his ability to handle the office, and he sort of sold himself as a package. And the problem for the Democrats right now is that Bush has his team, and he's got, in fact, a new cabinet secretary as well in Tom Ridge. And essentially, the Democrats are running against the entire administration, the Senate, the House, the Supreme Court, and everything. And one Democratic candidate's got to take on all that plus the money advantage. It seems like an overwhelming task. So why not ask for help?
Well, has this ever been done before? Is there any precedent for this?
Well, like I said, in 1976, as a last desperate ploy, Reagan invited Schweiker to run with him on his ticket to try to unseat Ford's nomination in 76. Ford was the incumbent president. But of course, it had come to the presidency by resignation, and this was done very, very late in the campaign season. What I'm arguing for is something a little different. I'm talking about pairing up very early, like as soon as perhaps right now, because what you have when you do this, sort of thinking outside the box, is you have two candidates and two spouses campaigning across the country, pooling their resources, pooling their contacts, pooling their ideas, and showing sort of a package to Democratic voters, certainly to superdelegates who are elite members of the Democratic Party who have a vote in, say, in the nomination, and saying, look, we are a team, and this is what you're going to get if you vote for us.
We've got an email here that sort of addresses this question. Mike Villers of Philadelphia says, if history and general expectations run true to form, Dick Gephardt will not be the nominee, but he sure should be the VP. Gephardt as VP would solidify the labor vote, help win 50-50 of Missouri's 11 electoral votes, and have an appeal in what is arguably the nation's only true battleground region, the Midwest. Now, if Gephardt would ever choose to take your advice, Tom, and decide not to run for president but to be a vice presidential candidate, who do you think he should be paired with?
Well, I mean, it's not for me to say that. I think the candidate at the top of the ticket has to sort of persuade somebody, and it doesn't have to be one of the current set of presidential aspirants. I agree with Neil. I think George Stephanopoulos sort of let the conventional wisdom out of the bag on Bob Graham as really perhaps eyeing the vice presidency. And in my column, I argued that perhaps the best candidate would be John Edwards, because he has a good chunk of money and he is still relatively young and he has a long career ahead of him. Gephardt might be a similar type of candidate. I don't see Gephardt being one of the people to drop down and run on the bottom of the ticket, as the emailer has suggested. But somebody like Wesley Clark, whose name has come into this afternoon's conversation, might be a good candidate on the bottom of the ticket. So might somebody like Bob Menendez, the congressman from New Jersey, because there's, as we all know, Hispanics are now the largest ethnic minority in the country, and that's going to be a key critical swing group that Karl Rove and the White House has its eye on.
Tom Schaller is assistant professor of political science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Neil Loxman, what's your take on Tom Schaller's proposal?
It would clearly change the dynamic of the race. I mean, I think it's a little too early for somebody to kind of do that. I think that I wouldn't say that's a Hail Mary play, but I think it's certainly a very interesting proposition. But I could see where John Kerry said, to Bob Graham, look, we represent two ends of the party in two different places geographically. Run with me. If I win this nomination, you're who I want. I mean, you have great, Graham is a very credentialed man. He was governor and senator of one of the biggest states in the country, and that's a place that Democrats had just won Florida, Gore would be president today. It clearly, in a major way, at least in the short term, would change the dynamic of what is going on now, Lynn, which is a muddled field of nine people or eight people, none of whom have broken out, and no one really paying attention other than hardcore Democrats getting less and less enamored with Bush and wanting somebody to emerge so they have somebody they can be proud of to vote for in a year and a half.
All right, let's take another call. Troy in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Troy.
How are y'all doing today?
Good, thanks.
I just have a question, actually. I'm interested on how do the nine candidates at this time interact with the major constituencies of the Democratic Party, specifically minority voters and labor?
Neil?
Well, they do it as aggressively as they can. They go to meetings. They court the leadership. They go to, you know, union conventions all over the country. They campaign at churches. I mean, remember, the presidential race is an electoral college race where what you care about is if you're a Democrat or 20 to 25 states. And in those 20 to 25 states, the Democrats have to win. California, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Massachusetts, New York. I mean, essentially, the states that Gore won, adding in Florida, two of the major prongs, two of the major, you know, building blocks of winning as a Democrat in those states are minority voters, African-Americans and Hispanics and labor. And so if you're any one of these people, you've got to work really, really hard to make sure that you do that, not just because it separates you and makes you win the primary, but because then the electoral math, you know, that's what you need for the electoral math in the general election.
What are the issues the Democrats are running on?
The economy. I mean, what all the Democrats have done, Lynn, now is they realize that that Iraq and terrorism is not Vietnam. That right now there really are two sides to it. When you're fighting this sort of weird war on terrorism that you're fighting, and such a bogeyman in Saddam Hussein. So all the Democrats make sure they pass the litmus test of being tough on terrorism. I mean, you know, I'm tough and, you know, I supported the president there and we've got to kick out Hussein and do all that stuff. And then what you do if you're a Democrat is you hope that 2004 is like 1992. Carvel's mantra, it's the economy, stupid. Well, today there's 6.4 unemployment. If 60 weeks from now there's 6.4% unemployment, Americans, at least Democrats, hopefully for the Democratic nominee, will make this a referendum on, you know, your job and prescription drugs and anything related to your personal security about money. And that's what the Democrats hope. The Democrats hope literally 68 weeks from Tuesday. The general election is 68 weeks from this coming Tuesday. The Democrats hope that this campaign will be a referendum on the economy. Bush wants and Karl Rove wants this election to be a referendum on how, you know, George Bush has restored world peace and erased this terrorism stuff, and the economy has turned around and we're out of this recession.
Who do you think the Republicans want to see run against President Bush?
I think they would be quite happy with Dean if he bumps up. I mean, obviously, forgetting Kucinich and Mosley Braun and somebody like that, I think that of these people, they would want Dean. I don't think they're scared of any of these folks. I think that regardless of what they said, they'd probably least like Kerry because Kerry can do that John Kennedy imitation.
We're talking about the early laps in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. Our guest is strategist Neil Oxman. We'll have a few more minutes with him after the break. We'll also be talking about the African country Botswana, which is next on President Bush's five-country visit to Africa. If you've been to Botswana or have some questions about it, give us a call at 800-989-8255. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Most of the battles being waged around the world are fought with small arms, guns that fighters can easily carry through city streets or on jungle paths. Tomorrow, a discussion of the proliferation of small arms. Right now, we have a few minutes left to talk about the Democratic presidential hopefuls with our guest Neil Oxman. And let's take a call from, we'll go to Francis in California. Hi, Francis.
Hi. I have a question. Do any of the Democratic candidates for president propose an alternative foreign policy to the current foreign policy of the United States of an endless war against terrorism and military expansionism and occupation? That's one question. Then I have a question about the economy.
Well, I think your question, Francis, is a little bit loaded, and I would guess that if you asked maybe all except Lieberman that question, they would probably give you an answer that would satisfy you, and it would be yes.
And on the economy?
On the economy, what specific programs do any of the Democratic candidates have about getting Americans back to work? I work in the telecommunications sector, and there's been over 500,000 telecommunication workers have lost their jobs. And a lot of work is going to other countries, India, et cetera, et cetera. So what specific plans do any of the Democratic candidates have to get people back to work, and then there are a lot of people just working part-time because that's all the work there's available.
Thanks for your question.
Back to full-time.
Thanks for your question, Francis. I think that's I think that is going to be something that Democratic candidates are going to have to address, Neil.
Yeah, I think most of them would say off right away, Francis, that they would repeal the president's tax cut for the rich, give much more tax relief to middle class people, do a better job of balancing the budget. I mean, you know, they would sort of give you anti-Bush answers about the economic policies that have failed, specifically about the tax cut first.
All right, let me read this email from Mary in Farmington Hills, Michigan. The field of nine and counting Democratic candidates cannot be whittled down to one soon enough. Although I'm only 57, I miss the old days when a candidate was selected in smoke-filled rooms by party leaders. The Democrats need to get the show on the road with one strong leader so we can fight the Republicans one candidate rather than fighting among ourselves.
Well, I think there are a lot of people who feel that way, Lynn, that they want somebody to emerge quickly, because I think lots of Democrats, including myself, feel that if the economy continues to go off on the wrong direction, that Democrats have a great chance of winning these 25 states, the same states that Gore won, and winning the Electoral College in 2004.
Okay, and let's go to Bob in Mansfield, Ohio. Hi, Bob.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to know is what mechanism exists so that this diverse group of candidates, after someone is nominated, can transfer their money to the winner of the nomination?
There is no real mechanism today because the Democrat will probably accept the federal matching funds. But, the losers...
And maybe you can explain how that works.
Well, if you become the nominee of the Democratic Republican Party, you get a certain amount of money from the Federal Election Commission to run the general election, although you can opt out, as George Bush has done, and he will raise a record amount of money, perhaps $200 million, to run for president. But what I think you'll see them do, Bob, is to take their campaign treasuries and just sort of run around the country and campaign for that Democrat, so in fact they will be taking their money and contributing it to the Democratic Party as well.
All right. Thanks for your call, Bob. And maybe we should ask you, what does President Bush have right now in terms of funds for his campaign?
Well, he raised, Lynn, as much money as all the other nine combined in the second quarter. He raised within 2 weeks about $30 million, and he will literally raise $200 million. And so when he has a chance to advertise between August 15th of 2004 and November 3rd of 2004, he will certainly have more money than any of the Democrats. And in a sense, he will be Coke and Pepsi to the Democrats' Diet Right Cola in terms of money on TV. So the Democrats are going to face sort of a daunting challenge because he's going to be spending a heck of a lot of money, you know, touting what he's done.
All right, let's go to Catherine in Milford, New Hampshire. Catherine, are you there?
Hi, yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment that I don't think any of the current presidential or Democratic presidential candidates can win against George Bush. And the American public wants an image that's macho and tough and pro-war, and I don't think any of the candidates have that. And they also need to point out to the working man that Bush is not on his side. And I don't know. I think we need Hillary Clinton.
So you're a...
She's macho and tough and, you know...
Yeah, well, people have a reaction to her. You know, I think people feel pretty lukewarm about the candidates right now. People will start talking, you know. People will start feeling passionate. And maybe through that, they'll arrive at something more of a conclusion than people are at right now.
Well, I think all you have to do is wait until 2008, and she's going to clearly, if the Democrats don't win the White House in 2004, she will run for president in 2008. I think she's clearly told the people of New York she's going to run for re-election in 2006.
Yeah, I'm actually not calling
I understand.
Hillary caller. I'm just saying, unfortunately, none of these candidates can beat Bush.
All right, thanks for your call, Catherine.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, patience, Catherine, patience.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Neil, just as a parting question, I wonder if you have and as somebody who is a political consultant and has run some campaigns, what is your advice to these, what advice would you give to the candidates? How would you tell them to get ahead of the pack, to really get noticed?
It really is very hard, Lynn. I mean, I think, you know, Dean is the one sort of doing that right now, because I think he's the angry person in the field, and I think he's capturing that anger that's out there. And I think that the only other way you can do it, other than raising a lot of money and to make sure that you, as Charlie Cook said at the beginning of your show, you know, money Iowa and New Hampshire, other than separating yourself by winning the Iowa caucuses or winning the New Hampshire primary, is it one of the defining moments of the campaign. And I consider in calendar year 2003 the defining moments of the campaign, how much money you raise or the joint appearances, is to just be terrific at those things. And sort of, if somebody's watching, just think, hey, you know, Dick Ephart, you were amazing, and I'm for you. And all of a sudden, you bump up 5 points in the poll. But it's very, very hard to do it, and you just have to run a better campaign than the other guys.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Neil.
Thanks, Lynn.
Neil Oxman is a Democratic strategist and president of the Campaign Group. He joined us from member station WHYY in Philadelphia.